Chapter 8. Keep Your Mind Steady. Dan Cleeter is a man of contrasts. A deeply thoughtful academic who is as comfortable waxing esoteric and philosophical as he is lifting large, heavy objects. The professor, who also happens to be a strength and conditioning coach, dons a series of abstract tattoos up and down his body. Hidden beneath his shirt is a dragon-like tattoo covering the entirety of his right side. Like most of his colleagues, Dan can lift heavy objects quite well. Look a little closer at his tattoos, though, and you might pick up on the subtle difference between Dan and the meathead image of the weightlifter that many possess. The abstract tattoos covering his legs represent movements in Tai Chi, a practice he holds close to his heart. Dan represents a newer breed of strength coach, a deep thinker with a PhD who is well-versed in everything from religion to philosophy. Sitting at a pub in the town of Twickenham, England, we turned our conversation to why he got his tattoos, and he gave a response worthy of his eclectic personality. Part of it is the meaning, but a part of it is the process. Lying there for hours, feeling the pain, and just having to deal with it. I know that may seem odd, but I swear I'm not a masochist. Dealing with pain is deeply intertwined with toughness. While pain is not typically thought of as an emotion like joy or sadness, it functions much the same way. Signals coalesce into a message telling us that something may be off. When pressed on his experiences in getting tattoos, Dan responded, "Sometimes you are lying there for 3-4 hours, and you aren't sure exactly when it will end. You just have to figure your way through it. Once the artist says he or she is done, you go from being able to last another hour, if required, to suddenly being flooded with all of these different sensations. You experience it all. It's emotionally exhausting at that point, and if the tattoo artists missed something and needed another 15 minutes to finish, it would be torture. I couldn't do it." While Dan isn't a monk, he also has an affinity for Buddhist traditions. "The key to being able to handle the pain and uncertainty," Cleeter quipped, "accepting the pain, not fighting it." Monks on a Mission. Antoine Lutz and his colleagues at the Laboratory for Brain Imaging and Behavior at the University of Wisconsin explored the same phenomenon that Cleeter experienced, pain. Only the researchers were after the inner workings of the mind, recruiting volunteers to lie in a brain-scanning fMRI machine, all while experiencing pain. Instead of a tattoo, volunteers were subjected to a different kind of discomfort, a hot probe placed on the skin directly below their wrist. While half of the subjects were your average Joe when it came to handling pain, the other half were a bit different. They'd each spent over 10,000 hours performing Buddhist-style meditation. When the painful probe touched the skin, both the meditators and the control group experienced the same intensity of pain, just above a 7 out of 10. However, when researchers surveyed the participants on the unpleasantness, that is, how much the pain was bothering them, the results were diametrically opposed. The novices rated the same pain intensity as nearly twice as unpleasant. Both groups felt the same amount of pain, but their reaction to it was entirely different. Peering into the expert meditators' brains provided an answer as to why. It started before they even felt discomfort. In anticipation of the scalding hot probe, an area in the brain related to emotional processing called the amygdala lit up in the novices, signaling a threat was on its way. Their monk-like counterparts had a comparatively low response. Before they even felt pain, both groups were preparing in drastically different ways. One was on high alert, readying for catastrophe. The other was aware but decided not to trigger the alarm. As the painful probe touched the subject's skin, the experts quickly habituated to the discomfort, decreasing it as they lay in the scanner, while the novices felt their pain grow. It wasn't that the expert meditators were shutting off their response. They had developed a different way to respond. Instead of sounding the alarm, they were taking an alternative route to deal with this foreign sensation. They were actually activating the insula, a part of the brain linked to integrating the significance of the sensations one experiences. Meditation had taught them how to not jump straight from pain to freak out, but to find another path, not by ignoring or forcing, but by accepting and working their way through it. When the expert meditators were asked about the experience, they didn't respond with tales of pushing through the pain or toughing it out. Instead, they described the pain as softer with less dwelling. They had a greater ability to fully embrace the feeling of pain and let go of the appraisal of what the pain meant to them. The researchers concluded that these individuals had somehow developed the capacity to flexibly modulate conditioned automatic reactions to an aversive event. In layman's terms, they'd figured out how to turn a nearly automatic reaction into a thoughtful response. They'd reappraised a signal that usually triggers alarm bells to be no different than a mild itch. They were responding, not reacting. Whenever we face discomfort or adversity, we often jump straight from feeling to freaking out, from the sensation of pain straight to the emotion that often comes with it. True toughness is about expansion instead of constriction. It's fostering the approach of the expert meditators, not to push against the experience, but to create space between the stimulus and response so that we can better navigate what's going on. It's the child who learns that the frustration from making a mistake doesn't require a tantrum. The husband who can sit with his frustration instead of lashing out at his loved ones. The athlete who can separate the jittery sensations of nervousness from the emotional response of anxiety or dread. How we respond is malleable. Two main areas in the brain play a role in responding. First, the aforementioned amygdala, which acts as both an alarm system and an interpreter for stressful content, both good and bad. It's not only monks and meditators who show an altered amygdala response. When exposed to painful stimuli, yoga masters were able to turn the emotional aspect way down. For the everyday person, when shown aversive pictures or given a painful stimulus, a lower amygdala reactivity is tied to better emotional control, while depression and anxiety are associated with a hyperactive amygdala. The counterbalance to the amygdala's panic button approach to threats is the prefrontal cortex, PFC. While the amygdala might trigger anxiety that wrecks our capacity to execute a task, the PFC acts to regulate emotional responses and maintain our performance on the task at hand. A recent study out of Yale looked at how the brain responded to being under the threat of receiving a shock while playing a predator-prey computer game. Participants showed a strong stress response in anticipation of being shocked, but they maintained performance throughout, thanks in large part to the connectivity between the two brain regions. The brain was able to modulate how it handled the emotional distraction. The PFC and related brain areas acts as the stabilizer, stepping in and saying, "We see you feeling anxious, but we don't have to sound the alarm." According to the latest scientific research, the connection between the amygdala and the PFC explains much of the individual differences in emotional regulation. While monks might have mastered this process, those suffering from burnout live on the other extreme. You are likely one of them. Burnout is epidemic in most Western countries, with surveys indicating that as many as 76% of U.S. workers experience its hideous effects. A general lethargy, lack of motivation, and feeling of malaise are hallmark symptoms. Burnout alters how we handle challenges. Put through similar stressful tasks as the aforementioned meditators, those who suffer from burnout have the opposite neural reaction. They have a slightly larger amygdala and a weaker connection to their PFC. With a weaker connection between the alarm, amygdala, and the response system, PFC, they can't step in until it's too late. Burnout trains our brain to react in the exact opposite way that meditation does, a hyper-reactive alarm without a break to control the runaway emotional response. The modern workplace is training us to lose control over our inner world. The same phenomenon partially explains why some performers can rise to the pressure-filled occasion of a championship game and why others seem to lose all ability. As stress and anxiety increase, the PFC shuts down, thanks largely to a flooding of adrenaline and dopamine. Too much arousal, and the thoughtful PFC is impaired, leaving room for the instinctive amygdala to take over. If you've ever felt like you've lost the ability to think while experiencing a severe bout of pre-performance anxiety, then you know what this inner shift feels like. Clutch performers are able to keep their PFC online, despite rising levels of stress and fatigue. There's a lot at stake for both the athletes and the burned out. We're all trying to tackle puzzles and problems while improving and thriving along the way. Working 80-hour weeks may seem like the answer, an act of toughness, the necessary work to accomplish our goal. In reality, we're lying to ourselves. Grinding through to burnout, ignoring stress and fatigue, is training our brain to shut down, and with it, our ability to thoughtfully navigate the actual challenge. Paying attention and accurately assessing the situation trains our mind to stay steady. As if prodding with a hot probe wasn't enough, researchers at the University of Wisconsin took it a step further with experienced meditators. They had them confront not one, but two stressful scenarios. First, they put them through every public speaker's worst nightmare, the Trier Social Stress Test, TSST, a cruel test developed by psychologists that consists of having people give a speech in front of a panel of judges, whose sole job is to criticize and taunt the poor speaker. The second stressor involved applying capsaicin cream to their body. Capsaicin is the active ingredient in peppers that gives them their heat. By combining a physical and social stressor, the researchers could track their stress response via the hormone cortisol and their inflammatory response via their bodily reaction to capsaicin. At the end of this grueling experiment, the expert meditators had a suppressed cortisol and inflammatory response, a clear demonstration that it wasn't just a change in psychology, but biology that explained how they responded to stress. The research team noticed one more interesting phenomenon. The meditators weren't tricking themselves or entering some pseudo-real state that allowed them to endure more stress, anxiety, or pain. They weren't using distraction or detaching themselves from the reality of what they were experiencing. The meditators were embracing reality. When researchers compared the physiological data with the self-report data, the meditators had a much closer alignment between perception and reality. The control subjects, on the other hand, had a distorted response. Their emotional response was exaggerated compared to what their physiology predicted. Not only did the meditators have an enhanced ability to regulate emotion, but part of that was due to the fact that they were more accurately assessing the reality of the stress they were experiencing. They had better accuracy in perceiving their internal state or less emotional elaboration of physiological cues. The difference between master meditators and you and me doesn't end once the pain is applied. Richard Davidson, psychologist and author of the book Altered Traits, has found that the alarm bell in the brain, the amygdala, has a distinctive response to a stressor. There is an initial spike within the first 5 to 8 seconds, and then a decline in activity for the next 5 seconds as the signal returns toward the baseline. When we think of emotional reactivity, we often concern ourselves with the former, the initial jolt, the sounding of the alarm. But research shows that it's not just whether or not the amygdala is activated, but also how long it takes to return to normal. In a group of over 100 research subjects, the slower amygdala recovery predicted how they evaluated their environment. Those with a delayed recovery were more likely to evaluate neutral facial expressions as negative. In addition, they were also more likely to display traits of neuroticism. Psychologists call this phenomenon affective inertia, an inability to let go of a sensation or emotion that has taken hold in our brain. Negative emotions or thoughts compound, triggering an increased reactivity and a more prolonged recovery tail. We can't let go of that snide remark by our colleague or the harsh criticism of our work the teacher offered in front of the entire class. It lingers, for hours and sometimes days, replaying in our mind. In this book, we've called this experience spiraling, catastrophizing, or the lingering effects of freakouts, where our emotions push and pull us in a particular direction. We lose control over our reaction and get trapped in a negativity spiral. As we spiral down, we are no longer responding to the actual stressful event, but the reverberating waves thanks to the effective inertia. When we combine the idea of effective inertia with the research that shows that expert meditators can better coordinate their biological stress response to the reality of the stress they face, a pattern becomes clear. The monks, yoga masters, and meditation experts are responding to reality. They muster the appropriate stress response for a situation and let it do its thing. The rest of us are responding not only to the actual stressor, but also to the anticipation and lingering reverberations of it. And to make matters worse, the more we learn or hang on to that experience, the more powerful our reaction is the next time we're triggered. As Davidson surmised on the Ezra Klein Show, in some sense, the average person is getting a triple dose of pain before, during, and after, whereas the long-term meditator is simply responding when the painful stimulus is delivered. While the neuroscience is young and ever-changing, the idea that we can weaken the bond between sensation and our response goes back millennia. These core principles make up a large portion of ancient Buddhist practices, from training us to not assign judgment to our thoughts and feelings, to teaching us to sit with sensations and experiences. Buddhist meditation practices are focused on helping us handle the inner workings of our complex mind. More recently, authors from Stephen Covey to Viktor Frankl have touted the benefits of creating space between stimulus and response. Creating space is a tool that we can all learn to use, one that helps us disconnect the initial sensation from the reverberating emotional response. And it's a skill that truly defines grittiness, because we are working through a challenge, not blitzing past it. We can change course at every step along the way, feeling, inner debate, freakout. Creating space is a way to disrupt the pattern, to slow down the jump from feeling to freakout. We do this through both conscious and unconscious mechanisms that can decrease the alarm or give us more time to work through our inner dialogue so that we don't fall into a catastrophe. The caveat for much of this research is that most of it was performed on meditators with decades of continual practice, something that most of us don't have the time or inclination to commit to. Fortunately, research shows that as little as 4 days of mindfulness training can reduce the feeling of unpleasantness. And mindfulness isn't the only route toward working on this skill. The same skill can be honed when you are working out, watching a scary movie, sitting at your desk, or talking to the barista at your local coffee shop. Creating space is a concept that's applied in one of the toughest environments in the world, a classroom full of six-year-olds. When my wife, Hillary, started her career as a first-grade teacher, clip charts were the go-to behavior management system. If you misbehave, your clip moves from green to yellow to red, a visual reminder for the whole class to see that you messed up. The results weren't promising. It didn't work. Instead of helping, it made kids feel worse. You took a child and dumped feelings of angst, guilt, and shame on top of an already tense situation. Tantrums soon followed, relayed Hillary. As the latest science and psychology entered behavioral management, the approach shifted. Now, if a student acts out or isn't following directions, Hillary says, I first provide them with a choice, asking, can you reset? A reset is a momentary pause, an opportunity for the child to think about their behavior or mistake and correct it. Teachers explain and practice resets throughout the year. If the child resets, the teacher quickly moves on. As Hillary summarizes, everybody makes mistakes, and mistakes are okay. A reset is a chance to think through your emotions and come back online. Children aren't used to or equipped to navigate the barrage of emotions they feel. Give them space to deal with them. And if the behavior continues, I give them two options. For example, you can start your assignment at your desk or at my table. Or you can reset now, or we can practice resetting at recess together. They feel like they have control as they're picking a choice, but I'm steering their behaviors toward what is acceptable. They can't just say no. Since teachers have adopted a modern behavioral approach, children still act out and make mistakes, but they learn, adapt, and grow. Tantrums and fits are down. It turns out that even with 6-year-olds, creating space, helping them navigate their emotions, and giving them a choice is crucial for teaching them how to navigate life's challenging moments. Existential psychologist Rollo May best captured the essence of what we are after when he stated in The Courage to Create, "Human freedom involves our capacity to pause between stimulus and response, and in that pause, to choose the one response toward which we wish to throw our weight." With the individuals that I work with, we've even given this search for space a name, creating the ability to have a calm conversation. Toughness maxim. Respond to reality. For most of us, we are not only responding to the actual stress, but the reverberations of it. Tough individuals learn to match perception with reality so that they marshal the appropriate response instead of an exaggerated one. Having a calm conversation. When I was a budding endurance athlete, I had a go-to method for dealing with pain. Ignore it until I couldn't anymore, then bulldoze through it. In the early years of my running career, it served me well. I was one of the fastest high school runners in the nation and thought I had this whole running through pain thing figured out. But the physical and emotional toll was deep. I'd run myself into the ground, throwing up after nearly every race. I took pride in what I thought was a sign of my toughness, a clear signal that I was pushing myself far beyond what my competitors were. It wasn't sustainable. In races where I didn't have the emotional reserve when it came time to reach down and summon something to get me over the hump, the well was dry. With no other tools at my disposal, I'd watch my competitors glide away as I'd slow down at the mercy of fatigue. As I matured as an athlete and then battled through vocal cord dysfunction, I realized that if I was going to survive, I needed to expand my mental repertoire. Whenever we face an unpleasant sensation or the negative mental self-talk that comes with it, there are 4 ways to deal with it. 1. Avoid or ignore. 2. Fight. 3. Accept. 4. Reappraise. My initial solution was to combine options 1 and 2. Ignore until I couldn't, and then fight through it. This is what I call the bulldoze method, and it's the basis of most of our conceptions of mental toughness. Will your way through discomfort. If you can't, that means you are weak. There's no way forward besides beating your head against the wall until somehow you are magically inured to the experience. The bulldoze method serves as the foundation for old-school toughness. It's why Paul Bear Bryant relied on conditioning drills and extreme heat, and why coaches yell and scream when your performance begins to falter. Much as my teenage self, many still believe that bulldozing through is the way to go. As we've learned, the latter two methods, accept and reappraise, form the foundation of mindfulness and real toughness. When we choose to ignore or suppress, we first have to direct our attention to a thought or sensation, signaling to our brain that it must be important. If we actively try to push it away or ignore it, we're doubling down. Our brain doesn't receive the signal that we should move on. It gets the message that something important must be in this signal, so it amplifies it. Anyone who has told either themselves or others to chill out or just forget about it is keenly aware of this phenomenon. Ignoring, avoiding, and suppressing backfire. Opening oneself up to experience whatever thought or sensation enters our conscious awareness does not give that sensation power. It drains it of its control. Research shows that when we practice opening ourselves up to discomfort, we are better positioned to handle it. Our brain dampens down the tendency to jump straight from feeling a sensation to sounding the alarm. Acceptance creates space, allowing us to let the sensation float away or evaluate and reframe it. As my running career evolved and I developed the ability to work toward acceptance, training and racing changed. I no longer had to amp myself up before every competition, hoping to find the will to run until exhaustion. Instead, I had a conversation with exhaustion. While before, the sensation of fatigue and effort was a signal to get ready to fight, now it was feedback, a sign that my body was working hard, that my gas gauge was starting to run low. Previously, I'd experienced panic or dread as the pain increased, and I became aware that I might not make it to the finish line at the current speed. Now I could work through it, deciphering what was a signal to pay attention to and what I could let pass by. A sharp pain in my Achilles might mean injury, but a dull burn in my quads just meant I only had one big surge left in my legs. My inner dialogue moved from, "Oh shit, this hurts, you're tough, push through the pain," to something much more tranquil. "Oh hey, this is getting uncomfortable. That's okay, it's supposed to hurt. This is normal and expected. Loosen up your arms and stay focused on the task." It wasn't that I'd transformed into a Zen master, immune to pain and anxiety. I still felt the same amount of fatigue, pain, and discomfort. I still had the same inner devil on my shoulder, screaming at me to quit. The difference was I had the skills to keep myself from jumping straight from feeling to freak out. That tiny lull made all the difference. That's the calm conversation. A calm conversation is about slowing the world down, creating space between fatigue and freakout. It's developing the ability to coolly, quietly, and non-judgmentally work your way through a difficult situation. The calm conversation is a tool used to handle the stress, fatigue, and urge to quit during a performance, or the anger, fear, and frustration during an intense argument. The more space we can create, the better chance we have to interrupt the downward spiral, to choose the difficult path back up instead of careening off the cliff. When using the calm conversation, we won't become immune to the influence of stress and uncertainty, but we can improve our decision-making under all conditions. In theory, a calm conversation is simple. When we start to feel a rise in emotions and our mind spiraling toward a freakout, it's pausing, talking yourself off the ledge, listening to the feedback your internal and external environments are telling you, and slowing the world down. Not by fighting, but by understanding that what you are experiencing is normal, that what you are feeling is telling you something important, and that you have the space to choose how you respond. The calm conversation creates the space to direct, deflect, or reframe the experience. Everything works in concert. Now that you know what it is, how do we develop the ability to have a calm conversation? It's a two-step process. 1. Create space. Spend time alone in your head. 2. Keep your mind steady. Develop the ability to respond instead of react. Step 1. Create space. Spend time alone in your head. You find yourself sitting alone in a tiny room, bed and toilet adjacent to one another. There's no entertainment to keep your mind occupied, or even a window to clue you in to the passage of time. And in some cases, only a sliver of light illuminates the room. You sit alone in the cramped space for nearly 24 hours a day, with nothing but your inner thoughts. Where are you? You've either paid a couple of $100 to participate in a silent dark room meditation retreat, or you are sitting in solitary confinement. The former is a cure for our mental ills, a cleanse of our inner world, promising to quiet the mind and giving the body an incredible rest, supporting its own natural rejuvenation. The latter, a punishment, meant to wear you down, show you who is in control, and what isn't acceptable in the prison where you reside. Two experiences, one meant to drive you to enlightenment, the other a barbaric tactic that pushes us to the brink of insanity. One that causes lasting psychological damage, including bouts of isolation panic, post-traumatic stress disorder, and lapses in memory and cognitive functioning. The other, which research shows can improve our perceptual awareness, loosen the bonds of our thoughts and worries to ourself, and lead to positive behavioral change. Both push us to do something we all struggle with, spend time alone in our head. Even outside of the extremes of isolation, we'd rather be anywhere but inside our head. In a study led by psychologist Timothy Wilson, individuals were placed alone in a room with no phones, friends, or objects to distract them. There was a chair to sit in and a table with a singular item on it, a button. Subjects were informed that if they pushed the button, a painful shock would follow. The choice was simple: either embrace the boredom and spend time thinking, or kill time by shocking yourself and inflicting pain. The logical answer is pretty clear. Mind your business and be alone in your head for a bit. Simple and easy. The behavior of the subjects told a different story. 67% of men and 25% of women chose to inflict pain on themselves rather than contemplate their thoughts for 15 minutes. One individual pressed the button an astonishing 190 times during the 15 minutes. That meant shocking himself every 4.7 seconds on average. The skill of being alone in your head is a foundational piece of developing toughness, and most of us are horrible at it. When we're alone with our thoughts, everything is amplified. The apparent power behind the feelings, thoughts, increase severalfold. Our likelihood of pushing toward rumination and spiraling increases. The solution is pretty straightforward. Get used to being alone in your head. While I am in no way suggesting spending time in solitary confinement, lessons from the extremes help illustrate the adage, "The dose makes the poison." A little stress that is within our control and that we are free to escape can push our body and mind to adapt. Even silent meditation retreats can push too far, moving us from acute isolation syndrome to a more dangerous chronic variety if we aren't prepared. Fortunately, to improve our ability to navigate the inner world, we don't need to go to such extremes. We don't need to walk into the weight room and try to squat 400 pounds in our first attempt. Like those resisting getting shocked, most of us are so poor at being alone with our thoughts that the 10-pound dumbbells will suffice. Take something that the majority of us do when exercising: listening to music. Exercising is a great time to practice being alone in your head. We've got an array of sensations bombarding our conscious mind for a long period of time. It's an excellent avenue for getting comfortable listening to our inner world. Yet, most of us choose to distract from the inner turmoil. In high school, Brittany Gonzalez was an all-star basketball player and a state champion in the 800 meters on the track. When she came to the University of Houston, her talents emerged at the longer distances. When running easy, Brittany found that music would sometimes help. It served as a distraction. But as the difficulty of the run increased, something changed. "Once you start hurting, music makes the internal battle harder," she explained to me. "My mind would wander, my pace would drift, and I'd end up running slower. I can't hear or feel the rhythm of my stride or my breathing. My arms are moving back and forth at a different beat than the music. My mind would jump around, from my form to the scenery." Running easy and running when your brain is screaming at you to stop are two different skills. Music grabs attention and distracts us from other feedback. You might have noticed the same phenomenon when working. Listening to music or maybe even a podcast helps when replying to emails, but it impedes when completing a task requiring deep focus. When we need to expend our cognitive resources on staying engaged, even the subtle beat of the music in the background sends us to sensory overload. When effort is required, you need to be engaged. It's why endurance athletes ditch the headphones to train the capacity to be alone in their heads. In an increasingly distractible world, we're slowly losing the ability to sit with our thoughts and experiences. When our inner self becomes foreign, we become hyperactive to anything it says. Our interoceptive awareness declines, as we lose the ability to read and understand our inner world. The explosion in mindfulness books, podcasts, and apps is a consequence of this deteriorating ability. We are looking for a solution to a distracted world where we increasingly don't need to deal with our inner self. When we train our ability to be alone in our head, to sit with thoughts and sensations, we're better able to disengage from negative stimuli. To be mindful means to be aware. It doesn't just mean some form of Buddhist meditation. Brittany trained her capacity by spending hours in her head on runs. No music, just her. She wasn't in some meditative state on every run, but over time she naturally developed the ability to shift her focus from her breathing to her form to her inner dialogue to nothing at all. She became comfortable with the sensations, thoughts, and experiences. Clinical psychologists have utilized more extreme measures, such as taking sensory stimuli away in the form of dark flotation tanks, to help reduce anxiety and increase interoception awareness. Similarly, with athletes who struggle with choking in sport, I've had clients practice their skill, be it shooting a basketball or putting, in the dark, to shift their perception and help them become aware and then navigate their inner world. We can develop the same skill when we work out, but also during everyday activities like cooking dinner, doing the dishes, or taking the dog for a walk. Notice the sensations and thoughts that arise, trying not to judge or assign meaning to them. Learn to tune in and tune out interoceptive feedback and external stimuli. Homing in on your breathing, noticing how your inner dialogue jumps from impatience to jubilation to what you're going to have for dinner. Scientific research validates such an approach. Cultivating awareness activates an emotion-regulating network that includes the amygdala. Researchers out of the University of Wisconsin found that when subjects were confronted with a fearful stimulus, conscious awareness improved emotional regulation and directed subsequent behavioral response by enhancing the interaction between the amygdala and prefrontal cortex, that vital link we've discussed at length. In one study, psychologist Regina Lapate and colleagues found that awareness seems to break otherwise automatic associations between initial physiological reactions and subsequent evaluative behavior. It's not that we always need to be consciously aware or directing our attention. In fact, over time, the process largely takes care of itself. But to develop that capacity, first, we need to train it consciously, to be aware. Notice where our mind is going, then direct it. The larger our capacity, the more space we can create between stimulus and response. Step one to developing the capacity to have a calm conversation is straightforward. Spend time alone in your head, be it on a walk, sitting on the couch, or when standing in line. That doesn't mean control your inner world. Just get used to it. See what it's like to sit with boredom, angst, or whatever other sensation arises. Learn to let your thoughts go where they may before nudging them back to the task at hand. Don't try to do too much. Just be alone in your head. It sounds simple, but it serves as the foundation. We need to develop the ability to be comfortable in our own head, to prevent defaulting toward filling that space by grabbing our smartphone or letting our mind wander uncontrollably. Thanks to hours of repetition, distraction and avoidance are often our default strategies. Distraction takes little effort, so it's easy to rely on it as a strategy. It's why most of us grab our smartphone at the first moment of being alone. Distract, rather than sit with even a slight feeling of unease while waiting for our friend to show up or the commercial to end. We need to overcome that ingrained reaction and to notice the world around us. Simply being alone in your head goes a long way. If all you do is leave the phone and headphones at home when you go on a walk, you'll start to stretch your mental muscle. But we can also be intentional about the skills we're trying to develop. I split them into three levels: noticing, turning the dial, and creating and amplifying. This progression builds upon what we learned in developing our interoceptive ability in Chapter 6, and our inner voice in Chapter 7. Now we're putting the pieces together. Noticing helps you learn how not to jump from stimulus to stimulus. Turning the dial trains you to tune into and out of the world, directing your attention where it needs to go. And creating and amplifying increases your cognitive capacity to examine and adjust your internal world. These skills serve as your foundation, allowing you to create space at rest before applying them when facing discomfort. Exercise: noticing. Practice boredom. 1. Sit quietly in a room with minimal distractions. Sit with eyes open or closed. It doesn't matter. 2. You'll start to feel different sensations, which may then turn into positive or negative thoughts. Sit with them. Don't focus on them or try to push them away. Just see where your mind jumps to and what you have a tendency to latch on to. 3. If you feel an urge to stop or check a phone, experience it. Don't fight it. See if it dissipates or grows stronger over time. Remember, the key isn't resisting. We're just trying to get your mind to experience the sensations and thoughts and not jump to a freakout. 4. When you start this exercise, aim for 5 minutes of practicing boredom. As you adapt, gradually lengthen the exercise so that you can sit quietly for 15 to 20 minutes. Exercise: turning the dial. Increase and decrease the volume. 1. Perform a task during which you usually utilize distractions. Maybe it's going for a walk or jog, cleaning the dishes, mowing the lawn, or standing in line at the grocery store. Choose an activity during which you usually listen to music or scroll on your phone to distract yourself. 2. Notice where your attention goes. Notice when you feel the urge to grab at your phone or fiddle with something. 3. After you've spent time noticing, try to gently nudge your attention to stay fully on task. If you are washing dishes, try to return your focus to the act of washing dishes. Zoom in to what you are doing, as if you're telling your mind what is essential. 4. Before you stop, practice directing your attention in the opposite way. Zoom out, away from what you are doing. Allow your mind to wander or to be distracted. 5. This practice is designed to create the ability to direct and let go of attention. At this point, it's not that one of the strategies is better or worse. We are trying to develop the capacity to have control over our attention. The hope is that over time, your mind learns to focus on what matters, ignoring what doesn't. Exercise: creating and amplifying using imagery. 1. Find somewhere comfortable to sit in silence. 2. Close your eyes and visualize yourself doing an activity that brings relief, not stress, such as walking through the woods, going on a hike, or playing a round of golf. 3. Fill in as many details as you can and engage as many senses as possible. See the grass, feel the wind brush against your skin, smell the flowers in the forest. 4. Once again, the key isn't to judge, but to experience. This form of mental imagery allows you to hone your sensory and visualization skills. The goal is to increase your cognitive capacity to create, amplify, and adjust your inner world. Step 2. Keep your mind steady. Develop the ability to respond instead of react. A little over a dozen of the best coaches New Zealand had to offer were gathered in a small building located in Snow Farm, a small mountain escape tucked away from civilization that doubles as a winter conditions car testing facility for manufacturers across the globe. For the next 4 days, New Zealand's brightest, alongside myself and fellow American coach Danny Mackey, would talk athletics. The event was organized by Athletics New Zealand's high-performance staff, and I was expecting the same spiel as the dozens of other conferences I'd attended. Talk about training, nutrition, and recovery, and argue over the minutiae of conditioning for sport. I sat upright in my chair opposite a New Zealand coach whom I'd met a day earlier. We faced each other head-on, knees inches apart. Our instructions from Emily Nolan, a top strength coach for New Zealand, were simple. No talking. Sit in your chair and stare directly into the person's eyes sitting across from you. After a few chuckles, silence commenced, and we attempted to comply. You could feel the level of discomfort in the room, the urge to look away, to crack the tension dominating those first few moments. Nervous movements, eyes darting from staring into their partner's eyes to the forehead to the side, and an occasional giggle were the norms the first minute. People were trying to cope with the challenge they'd been given. Staring at a spot on someone's face, or wryly smiling and laughing, were ways to ease the burden, to cope with the demands of the activity. As time went on, and people came to the realization that this could last well beyond the minute or two most had initially envisioned, the room's atmosphere shifted. Coping went out the window. Now it was about survival. With no idea how long this could go on, we had to choose a different way to make our way through the discomfort. Acceptance. As we passed into minutes 3, 4, and 5, the group's tension dropped, faces and bodies relaxed. We stopped trying to fight the unease of looking into a stranger's eyes. We embraced the discomfort, coming to peace with it until nearly 10 minutes went by and we were allowed to stop. Sighs of relief let out. By now, you should understand the connection between such an activity and toughness. It serves as a beautiful demonstration of putting your body in an uncomfortable situation and then working your way through it. There's no decision to be made, but if you let the charade carry on for long enough, your mind will stop trying to struggle or cope and accept the circumstances. That doesn't mean you give in. It means that you learn how to be comfortable with the uncomfortable. I've run this experiment on athletes and professionals, and the same pattern occurs. Cope until they all come to terms with the task and accept it. The first time I had come across this idea wasn't in athletics or sports psychology, but in a search for love. In a classic study, psychologist Arthur Aaron attempted to create a connection between individuals of the opposite sex by having them answer a series of ever more intimate questions about themselves before ending with 4 minutes of staring into each other's eyes. Aaron's research demonstrated that such a procedure increased closeness, primarily due to the combination of forcing vulnerability and total awareness. How well did Aaron's approach work? The first participants to go through the procedure, who had no clue what they were participating in, fell in love and got married. Upon reading the study in my 20s, the science nerd that I was tried it out on a first date. Despite my enthusiasm and staring at a stranger for 4 minutes, the results weren't promising. Still, my own failed attempt at love led to the aha moment of how awkward and uncomfortable the whole experience felt, especially the eye gazing. I'd found a new exercise for making people feel uncomfortable. Anything that causes slight discomfort and unease is an opportunity to train your mental muscle to create space. You can utilize physical discomfort, for example, a wall sit contest, dunking your hand into ice or holding your breath, lean into fear, public speaking, fear of heights, or sit with a pull of angst. Place your phone face down on the desk in front of you, no touching it while it beeps and buzzes. The actual activity is less important than the feelings that come with it. The goal is simple. Put people in an uncomfortable space, one where their anxiety and stress rise and their mind searches for an out. Then have them utilize the skills we've discussed throughout this book to keep their mind steady, to respond instead of react. Train them first, then put them through situations where they apply what they've learned. Our brains are pattern recognition machines, and there can be tight bonds between sensations and emotions, or emotions and inner dialogue, or any of those and a particular action. For deeply ingrained mental habits, your brain might skip right from feeling a particular sensation, for example, angst, to an action, for example, grab your phone. To weaken that bond, we need to create space. And once we have space, we can redirect toward a more productive response. That's what the calm conversation is all about. We need to put ourselves in a situation that elicits negative thoughts, sensations, or emotions, then utilize mental skills to work our way through them, to convince the brain that it's okay and doesn't need to go down the well-worn path of a freakout. This starts with general situations that might not be tied to your particular challenge, but that simply put you at unease. That allows you to work on creating space, being non-reactive, utilizing positive self-talk, or zooming your attention in and out in a safe environment where you have little fear of failure. Hopefully, by now, you can see why this conceptualization of toughness is so different from the one traditionally presented. If we try to rely on avoidance or fighting through, we often strengthen the bonds between feeling, emotions, inner dialogue, and action. The brain says, we are really trying to ignore or take on this thing. It must be important. Practice having a calm conversation. 1. Experience the sensations. Practice non-reactivity to them, interpreting them as information. 2. See where your thoughts try to go. Watch them arise and let the negative ones float away. Try to calmly respond with positive dialogue. 3. Feel the urge to quit or stop. Once you feel the urge to quit, try different strategies to navigate the urge. Sit with it, direct your attention toward or away from it, or utilize self-talk to work your way through it. The key is not fighting it. 4. Your goal is to create space between feeling the sensations and jumping toward the urge to quit. You're trying to decouple the feeling and the response. Applying the calm conversation to your situation. After the 2004 Olympics, psychologist Hap Davis took a group of elite-level swimmers and stuck them in an fMRI machine to scan their brains. Similar to a post-competition film review session that you'd see in football or basketball, the swimmers were shown videos of when they failed. Races where they'd fallen short of their goal, missed out on making the Olympic team, or let their team down. When watching their failures, the swimmers' amygdala lit up, with only a small activation in the brain's motor cortex. Their brains were sounding the alarm, triggering a reaction that amplified the negative emotions related to their own failure. After noticing the trend, Davis took the athletes and put them through a brief training program designed to rewire their response to their failure by understanding and evaluating the emotions and their response to them. After the intervention, the swimmers were once again subjected to watching their worst performances. This time, the internal response differed, with a smaller amygdala and higher motor cortex response. Davis told Time magazine, "Watching the failure washed out the negative emotion. Now I can discuss it with you, and it's no big deal." Once you understand the calm conversation, start small and general, then move toward larger and specific. If your nemesis is public speaking, begin with practicing the calm conversation in any situation that brings feelings of discomfort or angst. That could include physical discomfort, as in submerging your hand in some freezing water, or mental discomfort, such as watching an embarrassing video of yourself. The goal is to just learn how to sit with, then navigate your inner world. From there, move toward specificity. You could start with the nerves of introducing yourself to a stranger at the local coffee shop before practicing presenting in front of friends and family. The goal is to progressively develop the skill in situations that are closer and closer to what you might face. Mistake watching is a nice transition from feeling general discomfort to experiencing a situation connected to what we do. You can watch game footage, review a presentation, or even go over your sales reports with a friend or colleague. As you experience the swirl of feelings and emotions, sit with them, acknowledge them, label them, as we discussed in Chapter 6, reframe and learn to see them as old friends conveying information. Maybe you choose to reframe the inner dialogue or create psychological distance by imagining you're watching someone else. It's all about slowing your inner world down so that you can then go about deciding what's worth listening and responding to and what you should just let pass on by. By practicing the calm conversation while watching your mistakes, you are actively desensitizing your mind to the stigma. It's learning to turn on your kinder, responsive brain and turn off your triggered, reactive one. If you find yourself fighting the discomfort during this practice, step away. Fighting backfires. To turn down the trigger of the alarm, we need to convince our brain that our mind is steady and we don't need to flip the alarm. Training your mind is just like training your body. Gradually progress to more realistic and more difficult situations. Be creative. Whatever puts you in a place where emotions swirl and negative self-talk takes hold is an opportunity to employ the strategies we've discussed. Finally, practice utilizing the calm conversation in areas that are specific to our challenge. For some endeavors, this is easy, while others require creative thinking. The goal here is to mimic the sensations as best we can. If anxiety is the issue, then find something that triggers a similar level of anxiety. The following exercises provide a step-by-step guide for putting yourself in an uncomfortable situation and training your mind to work through it. Exercise: Mistake Watching. 1. Watch a video of yourself performing at whatever it is you do. 2. As you feel embarrassment or frustration in watching yourself fail, take note of the sensation. Evaluate the emotions that come with it. 3. Sit with the feelings and sensations. Try to create space and keep your mind from spiraling. Practice labeling the emotions, using psychological distancing, or any of a number of strategies we've discussed so far. Watch where your thoughts go and gently pull them back away from the freakout stage. Utilize the strategies you've learned, from breathing exercises to mindfulness training to redirecting your attention. Exercise: Let your mind go to a bad place while performing. 1. The only way to get better at something is to practice it. In this activity, practice whatever task you are trying to improve your toughness on. 2. While performing the task, let your mind spiral. Go toward the negative. Feel yourself about to experience a freakout. For example, as you rehearse your big presentation, go toward the devil in your head that's telling you that you don't know what you're talking about. 3. As you experience yourself spiraling, try to pull yourself out of it. Try to use different strategies, seeing what is effective in the moment. Coping strategies will be explored in the next chapter, but a few to keep in mind. 1. Zoom in, out. Change your attention, zooming in to where you're focused only on a narrow slice of the situation, or zooming way out so that your view is broad. 2. Label. Name what you're feeling or experiencing. Remember back to Chapter 6. Labeling takes away the power of the thing. The more nuance and clarity you can give your mind, the better. 3. Reframe. Alter how you are viewing the situation. For example, are you seeing stress as negative or positive? 4. Adjust your goal. Break down your goal into something manageable. Get to the next mile marker on your run or to the next section of your presentation. 5. Remind. Go back to your purpose for performing the activity. Remember why you started and why it matters. 6. Give yourself permission to fail. During any sort of challenge, we often go further into a self-protective mode when we become afraid to fail. Freeing yourself up to fail can free you up to perform to your potential. Finding equanimity. Upekkha is a concept that Buddhist monk Bhikkhu Bodhi described as such. A spiritual virtue, upekkha means equanimity in the face of the fluctuations of worldly fortune. It is evenness of mind, unshakable freedom of mind, a state of inner equipoise that cannot be upset by gain and loss, honor and dishonor, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. The concept is so strong in Buddhism that it's considered both one of the four divine abidings and one of the seven factors of enlightenment. In Buddhism, it outlines how to deal with change, or in our terms, discomfort. Upekkha translates to equanimity, which the Oxford English Dictionary defines as mental calmness, composure, and evenness of temper, especially in a difficult situation. The Buddhist religion isn't the only one to value equanimity. Hindu scripture proclaims to perform your duty equipoised, O Arjuna, abandoning all attachment to success or failure. Such equanimity is called yoga. In Stoic philosophy, the concept of ataraxia, a state of serene calmness, is emphasized, while in Christianity, the Bible is littered with references to having patience in order to persist. One example can be found in the book of Luke. In your patience, possess ye your souls. Next to this passage, John Wesley, the founder of the Methodist Church, wrote in his 1765 commentary, "Be calm and serene, masters of yourselves, and superior to all irrational and disquieting passions. By keeping the government of your spirits, you will both avoid much misery and guard the better against all dangers." In other words, equanimity. We started this chapter with monks and meditation before meandering through the world of athletics and love. It's only fitting to end back where we started. Creating space, being tough, and responding instead of reacting are all forms of equanimity. The concept of equanimity often gets confused with not experiencing or even suppressing emotions. But as we learned, even the deepest of meditators experience love and fear to the same degree. They just respond to it in a different way. It's the ability to keep your mind steady so that you can choose how to respond. Whether we call it equanimity, a calm conversation, patience, or responding instead of reacting, cultivating the space to choose the way forward is key to developing toughness. In his book Transcend, Scott Barry Kaufman defined equanimity as a cultivation of mindfulness and observation, of not pursuing one's purpose with blinders on, but constantly being open to new information, constantly seeking wisdom and honest awareness of reality, and constantly monitoring your progress and impact on your own personal growth, as well as the impact on others, radiating warmth and openness as you encounter the inevitable stressors of life. Equanimity and toughness work in concert.